Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What's the best advice about acting that you ever got?
The best advice about acting that I ever got? Maybe it's from Sidney Poitier. He said, if I could say one thing to you, irony. That was it.
What did that mean? What did that mean?
It meant that you don't always have to play the note. You can play in between the note. Always playing the note. We hear it, but do we really feel it? In those moments that are most tragic, where's the comedy? You know, in those moments that are most comic, where's the pathos?
Jeffrey Wright is one of the great character actors of our time, a true chameleon who can play any role in the world. He's also a Brooklyn guy who lives around the corner from me, and I run into him on the street all the time. Right now he's on hiatus from making the new Batman and spearheading a project helping Brooklyn hospitals get food from Brooklyn restaurants, thus feeding our courageous healthcare warriors and helping some iconic Brooklyn restaurants stay in business. Jeff is a really interesting guy on screen and off, so let's go. It's Jeffrey Wright on Torre Show. So, Jeff, you got a really interesting situation going in terms of taking care of people in Brooklyn, healthcare workers via the restaurants in our area. You live around the corner from me, so I see what you're doing. Tell the people what you're doing and how they can help you.
Well, the healthcare workers are taking care of us and the first responders. So what we're trying to do is really support them by providing them meals so that they don't have to be concerned about where food is coming from, because obviously most of the restaurants are closed around here. At Brooklyn Hospital, for example, you have folks working 15, 16-hour shifts, many of whom weren't going home. So a guy named Lenny Singletary there, who's the VP for External Affairs, said that he could use the augmentation of their cafeteria. So we started on March 27th with 100 meals to Brooklyn Hospital from two restaurants, Brooklyn Moon and Graziella's. It was really Vito Randazzo over at Graziella's who kind of kicked this off. He'd been delivering, or rather asking customers to purchase pizzas on behalf of staff at Brooklyn Hospital. He delivered a few pies over there. And someone pinged me on Twitter and gave me the heads up, because meanwhile, I had been trying to support my friend Michael Thompson over at Brooklyn Moon to let folks know that he was now more delivery oriented, because his is a social space, his restaurant. He's been there for 25 years, but not really delivery oriented. And when it became clear that we were going to go on lockdown, I said, "Hey, Mike, you got to, you know, be aware of what's about to happen here and focus on the delivery side. And I'll try to boost you on social media to the extent that I can." So shortly thereafter, after we went on lockdown, I reached out to him. I said, "Hey, Mike, how'd you do today?" He said, "Bro, I had five orders, which is not going to sustain you know, any restaurant unless you're charging $10,000 a meal, you know. So when I heard that Vito had connected with Brooklyn Hospital, I asked him to connect me with Lenny over there. And we got the ball rolling in that way, just with two restaurants, Brooklyn Moon and Graziella, one hospital, Brooklyn Hospital, 200 meals a day after the was what we agreed to. But the first delivery was 100 meals. And we called ourselves Brooklyn for Life. So we set up a GoFundMe page. You can check that out and you can support there. You can go to brooklynforlife.org and you can click on a donate button there, which will send you to the GoFundMe page. But now we have 41 restaurants in rotation. We're averaging about 2,500 meals per day. We just crossed the 40,000 meal mark. That's all since March 27th. We're delivering now to six hospitals in Brooklyn, one in Lower Manhattan, New York Presbyterian, because everybody wants to be in Brooklyn. So they slid into our circle and we welcome them. And every EMS station in Brooklyn, that's 10 in all. So it's about trying to help our healthcare workers. But at the same time, the healthcare workers are actually helping the community via the demand and allowing these restaurants to stay in business. But of course, they can't stay in business without the funding. And so the community has supported that. But as well, we've gotten donations from around the country when we started, because people realized that New York was, you know, the hot zone. And so it's just been amazing the way people have stepped up. We've raised, last I checked, over $180,000 on the GoFundMe page. I will say that there's been about $125,000 that has been contributed outside of the GoFundMe page directly to our 501c3. So we've raised over $300,000 to this point, but we need more because meals are flying out the door, and with those meals go the money. So we definitely welcome the support because we want to keep this going as long as it takes, as long as we have to. And at the end of the day, you know, we'll have kept 40 restaurants in business through this thing. And if you looked at what happened just now with PPP, with the small business loan project that had been set up in response to COVID, you know, you're reading that places like Ruth's Chris Steakhouse got, you know, several million, Shake Shack, Andy Meyer, 10 million, but they just announced that they're returning that. Good for him. But you could pretty much anticipate it because you have these big chains and there was a loophole that allowed for any restaurant that doesn't have more than 50 employees at any given location. So you don't aggregate the total employees, but at any, so there was a loophole that allowed these larger chains to slip in there. And of course they have the executive power, they have the lobbyists, they have the legal teams and the accountants to jump on that opportunity when local small, mom and pop small biz soul food joint over in Nostrand doesn't have that. So, we at least are supporting these restaurants directly if they don't get access to this government support.
And if people want to help, it's brooklynforlife.org.
It's brooklynforlife.org, or you can go to our GoFundMe page, which is Brooklyn for Life GoFundMe. You can Google that or Google my name as well, and you'll find us there. And you'll read our story and give as much as you feel.
In your relationship with the medical professionals as you're doing this, are you seeing in the last, let's say, week, a lessening or a flattening of the curve? Are we reaching a plateau from what you're hearing, or are we still going up? Because the reporting of the numbers is all over the place. I don't trust anything we're hearing.
And from what I'm, from what I'm hearing directly, from what I'm hearing directly from hospital reps and also from a guy named Anthony Almuera, who is the vice president for the EMS Officers Local Union here in New York. Incredible guy. He, too, has been feeding me some good info to ground truth this thing. So one of the gauges that he uses is pretty troubling one. So on 9/11. there were 6,500 calls for paramedics and EMTs, 6,500 throughout New York. But of course, sadly, on that day, a lot of those calls didn't require patient care because there were no patients. There were, a lot of folks, most folks didn't survive that, right? But you had 6,500 calls that day. During the late March or the beginning of middle March, or sorry, beginning the third week of March, I believe, into April, for about 3 weeks, that number, 6,500, was smashed every day. You had up to 7,200 calls on any given day. Other days, you had 5,000. Yeah, I think on average, they have 4,200, 4,500 calls. But they were beating that 9/11 number every day. And of course, with each of those calls was a patient in need. So they were under incredible stress. I mean, we could hear it here in Brooklyn. We could hear this strange symphony of sirens throughout the night. That was just, I just found incredibly eerie because for every siren, there was a story there of trauma, not only for the patient, but also for those folks who were responding, those EMTs and paramedics. And I think that's a story that we want to keep an eye on going forward, because he's described to me that they're finding themselves in situations that they can do nothing about. Cardiac arrests related to COVID, where you show up and there's really nothing you can do. You can't take the patient in for secondary care. And, you know, they're having numbers, you know, a dozen cardiac arrests a day that these EMTs and paramedics are experiencing. And the moral injury on that is going to be something that we need to take care of, that we need to keep an eye on, because I think there's some people in need from a mental health standpoint. So yes, it seems to me now, according to him, those numbers are starting to lessen. They're still not down to normal rates. And also at the hospitals, it seems that there's fewer folks coming in, less hospitalization, but of course they're still pretty stacked in there with patients who are sick in ICU, and also patients who are unfortunately not making it through this thing.
Jesus, you know, your commitment and your heart is always big. The last time we did a big talk like this, you had just come back from, I believe, from Africa, right? Trying to help out with Ebola. So you're always somebody who's committed to helping the people, not just in this situation.
I had been working in Sierra Leone for many years, and it just happened that the area in which we worked, I was focused more in Sierra Leone than I was on acting for about a decade. And the area in which we operated was 40 miles from patient zero during the West Africa Ebola outbreak. So that educated me intensely on some of the consequences of a situation like this. But more importantly, I had the opportunity to meet people like Tony Fauci, Larry Brilliant, who is part of the team that's credited, when he was at the WHO, was part of the team that was credited with eradicating smallpox globally. So I had a chance to meet folks who really know this world. And so when this outbreak occurred, my ears pricked up, and I also had a pretty good sense as to where to go for good information. So yes, this is not, in some ways, not my first unfortunate rodeo with this stuff. I've tried to do what I could to help in these situations, because what else are we going to do? we're going to sit and watch the television all day and have our heads explode and, throw wine bottles at the thing. I'd have gone through every television in this house by now if I just sat and watched that thing, man.
Well, all right. When you're not watching the news, what do you watch? What are you liking? What are you enjoying watching right now?
Oh man, I'm not watching much right now, really, because this project has really taken up much of my focus. I did watch Tiger King. I saw that. That was
how great
grind,
was that?
Man. That was a grind, amazing. Though. That was a lot of them folks, though, man. That was a lot of those people to digest. You know, like, ooh, my
everybody in this show is crazy. Every single one.
Oh, man. But hey, America, baby. You know, they're out there. They are out there in more ways than one.
Michelle Obama is one of the most inspiring, intelligent, graceful, unapologetically Black people that I could think of. Just her existing makes me happy, makes me feel inspired, makes me want to be a little bit more like her every day, because she seems to be just this extraordinary person. So if there's any sort of podcast about her, I want to listen to that. Life Kit from NPR has a whole episode on Michelle Obama. It's part of their whole Black Stories, Black Truths collection, where you'll hear stories of Black joy, Black resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account of what it means to be Black today from a unique Black perspective. There's a Code Switch episode about Dr. King, and I love Code Switch. There's It's Been a Minute about Eric Andre, who I love. We are not the same person, even though a lot of people think we look alike, even though he lives in my neighborhood now. But stop telling him he looks like me. Stop telling me I look like him. There's a pop culture happy hour about the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I loved that show. That show meant so much to me. This is what Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR is all about. Stories about Black America and Black culture. Whole pop culture happy hour on Abbott Elementary, which is another amazing modern Black show. From Megan Thee Stallion to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, to the women behind the Montgomery bus boycott, to the Color Purple, the stories of Black Stories, Black Truths will take you inside the Black community and Black culture. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham. A keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colm McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book, available wherever books are sold.
Well, a lot of people are getting by watching your work on Westworld and some other places. So I do want to talk about you as an actor, because you've been one of the great actors in the game for a long time. Can we talk about acting a little bit? Just like, what do you love about acting?
What do I love about acting? I think what I have grown to love most about acting is working with the other folks. And I don't only mean the actors. I mean, I like being on sets or on stage with a crew of people that you don't necessarily see through the camera lens or on the stage when the performance happens. I really enjoy, it's a hugely creative process. And I just enjoy that. I enjoy holding my end of the thing down. You know, I enjoy walking through the carpentry shop and checking out what the guys are doing and, you know, and saying, hey, you know, hey, just poking around. I got in trouble doing that at Pinewood. We were shooting Batman in January and I ended up wandering onto this a set that wasn't ours. And I almost got into it with one of the guys over there. But I love doing that. I love just drifting around and, you know, poking in with the special effects guys and seeing, you know, how they bring their craft to bear on the thing. And I love when the camera rolls and, you know, it's pointing at me. I love doing my thing and having, for example, the, you know, one of the there's a grip on Westworld named Mike Anderson. And he also makes dollies and all these incredible, he's a really talented dude. And he'll look at me, you know, in the morning and look me in the eye. We shake hands and it's time to roll, baby. He has confidence in me. I have confidence in him. And I love that aspect of what we do. And a lot of people don't appreciate that who aren't, you know, who are outside of the business. And that's really what I enjoy the most. Also, you know, finding a good piece. You have to have a good piece, good writing at the center of it. But once you get that, that for me makes the groove, you know?
I mean,
it really does.
I mean, I've known you a long time. And so when you perform your magic, I always believe that you are who you say you are. There's no like, oh, that's my man, Jeff. It's like, no, that's Colin Powell or that's whoever you're playing. And the depth of the conviction is so powerful. How do you do that? How do you make me forget, yo, that's my man, and like be like, yo, I 100% believe he is who he says he is.
Well, you know, that's part of the fun for me too, is adapting, you know, trying to shape myself, my ego, my thing around the character that I'm supposed to be portraying, supposed to be creating. And that, it keeps me busy because, I'm flexible, you know, if you can't beat them, confuse them. So I, you know, I don't have necessarily, a type, or, you know, I've never been pigeonholed. And so I enjoy that aspect of it. And it also allows me greater opportunity. And I just use everything I can. I use all the tools I can, voice, body, eyes, use the work of the costume designer. You know, make sure that the shoes inform the way I move, you know, all of these things, you know, add to, and increasingly now, you know, I use the wig department, you know, the wig makers out there, you know, I use all the tools I can to create someone outside of myself who, you know, of course is infused with who I am. But I'll say one more thing too about, you asked me my favorite, you know, why I like acting. There are two things too that I like about being on a movie set. One is when the camera rolls. The other is when we go home. That's two best parts. When the camera rolls and when we get the fuck out of there. You know, because they're long days and, you know, it's a grind. And, you know, when that camera rolls is when kind of time stands still. And everyone focuses. There's a quiet. And you're not aware that you've been there for 17 hours. You're just inside that moment trying to tell that story. And then the camera rolls again and you're back to the tedium of waiting and all that stuff. Or the camera cuts and then you're back to the tedium. And you know, but ideally you get a good flow going. And then you say, okay, you know, that's, you know, martini. That was the last shot. Okay, let's get the hell out of here. those are the two best aspects of it.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
I've had other actors on here and they've said most actors are not chameleons. You're kind of doing a version of yourself all the time. But I think you're really a chameleon. Do you think that's accurate?
That's part of the fun for me. Those were the actors that I really was drawn to when I started, you know, guys like Dustin Hoffman, mm-hmm. who always had some kind of theatrical tricks that he brought to bear, and he never was quite the same in any role. You know, a guy like Alec Guinness, you know, who would love, you know, I'd love the theater, the theatrics of that stuff. And that to me was was what it was about. It was about just crafting a character, you know. You don't wear the same pair of shoes every day, you know. They shoe designers, well, maybe I do, but designers make different shoes. We just, you know, we actors, the ones that I respect the most, make different characters, you know. They just that's part of the challenge.
You talk about Dustin and Alec. Do you have a top five or a list of top actors? Yeah.
Top five actors. Off the top of my head, if I thought of the folks early that I really appreciate it, I'll go back. Of course, you know, you got to go with like Sidney Poitier.
Yes.
My first ever close-up or semi-close-up single shot was opposite Sidney Poitier in a miniseries called Separate But Equal. He played Thurgood Marshall. I played Bill Coleman, who was the youngest of the attorneys at the Legal Defense Fund during the Brown versus Board of Education case. And I was 22 years old, 21. I just out of college, just moved to New York about a year before. And I had no idea what I was doing. I just started acting my junior year of college, and I got this role. Or they asked me to come in for the role because I was a political science major, and they assumed I knew a little bit about this subject, which I did. And that's why I got the role. I had no idea what was going on. But that first single with me, I looked up, Sidney Poitier is on the other side of the camera, and they say, roll it. And I'm like, oh my God, I have no idea what the hell I'm doing, but I'm going to fake it, baby. And he is such a beautiful man. He was so gracious. Me, a little knucklehead, you know. He was so generous and just such graceful leadership qualities that he exuded. So Sidney is right up there. He had been before that to Sir with Love, you know, just my, you know. Well, you know, as a kid, my heart just, you know, it just filled, you know, with what he did and the stories he told and what he represented. So Sidney, of course, Marlon Brando, you know, I mean, yeah. You know, it is what it is. Dennis Hopper.
Yep.
I'll tell you one that a lot of folks sleep on who I think is, I mean, just so super bad, was Adolf Caesar.
Soldier Story.
Soldier Story and Color Purple. How he didn't win an Academy Award, I don't even know if he was nominated. I believe he was, but come on, man. Mm. I mean, those two performances, particularly Soldier Story, is as bad as it gets, period. And another actor... who really influenced me in very specific ways was Gary Oldman. And actually he and Dennis, I got a chance to work with on Basquiat. And that was pretty special for me. Of course, David Bowie, Chris Walken, you know, everyone who came through Benicio on that, you know, but Gary, was a very specific inspiration for me. For example, you know, a lot of people like Peoples and Shaft, you know, Peoples is kind of out there, you know. He has his moments of intense emotional expression, you know. He puts it out there. And I can say very specifically that the way I was able to go there was a result of watching Gary Oldman and Sid and Nancy and going, man, this dude is bringing it. He's not like, there's no governor here. There's, you know, there's no 11 for him. That whole thing just goes, you know, he just cranks it up. And I was like, wow, that's possible. And so Gary was a very specific influence on me. And, you know, working with him at the, you know, early in my career was a great gift. And likewise, Dennis Hopper, same. And, you know, so I've had the benefit of being inspired by folks who I've actually had a chance ultimately to work with. And Dennis, when we did Basquiat, the first scene that we filmed was a scene in which I walk into, I'm outside with Benicio. We see Andy Warhol, David Bowie, and Dennis, who played Bruno Bischofberger, walk into this restaurant, and I follow in with some postcards that I have created to try to sell to them. So the first scene that we shot in that movie was that interior scene around the table. The two of them sitting at the table, I come in, you know, just Bogart, and try to sell these cards. So we came, we rehearsed that scene, and then I went back to hair and makeup, to the trailer, and I'm sitting in the chair, and they're doing whatever, I don't remember exactly what they're doing, and Dennis walks into the trailer. And he leans into my ear, and he says, "Cool." And I was like, oh, man, that was it. That was like the blessing, you know? I was ready to roll.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon, a mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com or wherever books are sold. All these great people you've been around, studying the craft, learning from, what's the best advice about acting that you ever got?
The best advice about acting that I ever got? Maybe from Sidney Poitier. He said, and I knew exactly why he said it when he did, I think I might have asked him that. Any advice for me? at the end, once we finished the shoot down in Charleston, South Carolina, and he said, if I could say one thing to you, or maybe he offered it. He said, if I could say one thing to you, irony. And I knew why he said it, and I took it on board. That was it.
What did that mean? What did that mean?
It meant that you don't always have to play the note. You can play in between the note. Always playing the note. We hear it, but do we really feel it? So in those moments that are most tragic, where's the comedy? In those moments that are most comic, where's the pathos? you know?
So, well, I mean, you know, that goes to what I want to talk to you about too. When you get the script, what do you do? What are some of the first things you do?
I just read them. And if the music compels me, if I feel it, then I read more and I get excited about it. I just read what's on the page, read the story, the way it's presented, the way it's written, the structure of it, the language, or just that's it. I just take it in. And I try to stay open to to all the different processes. I don't really have any kind of one thing that I do. I stay open. I try to stay open and allow myself whatever needs to be done. I'm telling.
I try to talk to people, and I think you have a great sense of the responsibility to the ancestors. And I wonder where that shows up for you in your work, because you definitely seem to be deeply conscious of the people, both actors and Black people, you know, who led to you having the moment that you're having.
Well, I mean, I just try to advance the ball down the field, you know? I just try I've been influenced. So I try to honor those influences and just try to see if I can stand on shoulders and elevate it a little bit more if I can, you know. Don't always succeed, but every once in a while. Yeah. I mean, that's how we live. It's not solely subject of how we work, but also how we live, right? You know, that's how I was raised anyway. I think we at times now perhaps forget that there were folks who came before us. You know, I think we think we created it all. We think, you know, we look at the political sphere right now and, you know, I hear from certain younger folks, you know, that no revolutionaries that came before them, you know, it's all happening now, but it's just, foolish to think that could be true, whether it's, in art or in life. So, yeah, of course.
I mean, in acting, it's very tangible. We are old enough to remember when there were very few Black people, you know, getting on the small screen or the big screen. And feels like now we're in a cinematic golden age for Black people in terms of the people who are in front of and behind the camera who are getting to tell really authentic stories. Does it feel like a sort of golden age to you?
Well, I think there's a lot more content out there now, or at least there was until this COVID outbreak hit. There are just more avenues for storytelling now. There's more content generally. And yes, Black artists have been taking advantage of that in really exciting ways. You're talking about folks coming before, one of the things that has been kind of surprising to me and gratifying is there are a lot of like really great young actors working right now, and I'll run into them and they'll say that I had an influence on them. So there's a lot of great stuff happening right now, and it's a function of, yes, the talent that's out there, and also a function of the opportunity for that talent to do its work. Cause that's really what it's always been about, is having the opportunity. It hasn't been, of course, for a lack of ability. It's just too often the doors were shut, but now there are more doors available to us.
What is it in you that has led to the success that you've had? Cause lots of people tried hard. You know, what is it in you?
The thing I think that has really assisted my career is my education. It's a pretty simple story. I write reasonably well, and I know how to interpret language reasonably well, and that's a function of training. And I don't mean as an actor, I mean training by the English teachers that pounded, you know, syntax and sentence structure and things like this into my head that have allowed me the tools needed to interpret language. It's also, I was a political science major, as I said, so my interests and my education exist outside of solely of filmmaking, film, and acting. And that's given me an advantage in terms of, again, how I interpret things or what I'm able to reference in any given role. So education, period. Any young actor that I work with, sometimes I work with kids. It's my last question to them, in front of their parents. Okay, you're on set now. You've been, working. When are you going to college? And, college isn't for everyone, but education certainly is. And that's it. And that's been my key, I think.
I mean, I definitely feel that because, you do some complex, intelligent pieces and it fits, and I can feel the depth in the mind working. I mean, Westworld in particular is a really complicated, layered piece. And I know, if you really like the intellect going, that's got to be a lot of fun to do.
But that's what you want to be ahead of the audience. You don't want to do stuff that's, sitting behind audiences leading you down the path. Yeah. So try to find those writers who are pushing the edge. Jonah Nolan, Lisa Joy are two showrunners, are writers like that in the writing room. They're really pushing, pushing the boundaries. And we have a premise that allows us almost endless exploration. We can go do anything. And I recognize that when I read that first script, because I hadn't seen the movie at Westworld. I went and saw it and went, oh, okay. And then Jonah sent me the script, the pilot for the first episode. And it was clear. It's like, wow, okay, for first thing, the structure of that first story was really well conceived. The architecture of the writing was fascinating. The use of repetition and the ways in which it kind of folded in on itself, simply in the writing itself. And then there was a poetry to it and an efficiency to the language that I appreciated. And then there was this sense that, again, that we could go anywhere with these stories. And if you're going to be a part of a series that is going to go on for several years, you don't want to find yourself grinding down on the same in the same tracks. It was clear that we had a lot of pathways to explore through this thing. And so that's what drew me to it. Literally reading that first script.
When you started, this craziness started, you were up in London working on the next Batman. The cast for that is incredible. The story sounds incredible. What can you tell us about what's coming up with that project?
We were in the middle of it, having a ball, and we were sticking our feet in that thing. It's really cool. It's really cool vibe that Matt Reeves, the writer and director, has created. And we had been filming for about 2.5 months, and then we shut down indefinitely now. But it is Batman is an interesting world. It's an interesting set of stories. It begins back in 1939 is the first the first comic. And so it's evolved since then and expanded and explored new, you know, the new realities of the day in a sense. And what's interesting about it is, Batman is like the one, I think, superhero who's actually grounded in the world, in our world. He's not, you know, kind of extraterrestrial. He doesn't have all these extraordinary powers. He lives in Gotham. You know, he lives basically in New York City, Chicago, you know, big American metropolis. And he's a detective, you know, kind of navigating through the corruption and the muck and the decay of a city that looks very much like one we're familiar with. So there's a lot of fun stuff to get your hands around with it. And then, of course, you know, it's just like some of the cool toys that we get to play with on this thing. It's I think Matt's really putting his signature on it, and a signature that will further help the stories, the Batman series, evolve in a way that's super cool and makes total sense. I really dig it.
When Michael Keaton was Batman, it was beautiful, but it was campy, right? And that's not a diss. I love those pieces. And when Christian Bale did it, it was edgy and dark. And now Robert Pattinson is playing Batman. So, you know, and like you said, new director, new writer. So where does it fit in with the other Batman pictures? I know it's not going back to the campy. It can't be as edgy as it was with Christian Bale and Chris Nolan. So where are we? Where's the vibe now?
Without giving too much away, how would I describe it? You just have to wait and see. You know, the real camp was Adam West. You know, that was the OG. I mean, for modern audiences. And in fact, you know who the first Batman was?
Who?
The first Batman was the father of Michael Wilson, who is half brother to Barbara Broccoli and who produced James Bond series.
James Bond. Mm-hmm.
Michael Wilson's father, I forget his first name. Sadly, but he was the first Batman. But for me, the first Batman was Adam West. And, you know, at the same time, though, yeah, it can't be all of that, you know. But Matt and I, who were about the same age, were saying, you know, but when we were kids, it didn't seem like camp. I mean, that was real, you know, daring do and all that stuff, you know. That was, you know, and the Batcave and the technology, all of that stuff was... You know, that was leading, you know, that was on point stuff. You know, that was the coolest stuff outside, really, James Bond that you saw, you know, on TV for us. There were some other places to go to, but, you know, it wasn't camp then. But no, we're not going back there. We're not revisiting those pastels. I can tell you in terms of kind of palette, which you've seen perhaps from some of the shots, it has a really rich tone. It's got a warm tone, but there is a moodiness, you know. There's a mystery to it. There's a mystery to the tone, and a raininess. It's super cool. It's super cool.
Nice.
I'm excited to finish it, and then I'm excited to have people see it. Yeah.
Last thing, you know, I ask everybody, what's your superpower? You know, what do you do a little bit better than everybody else that allows you to have the success that you've had? You know, what's your superpower?
My superpower. My superpower would be probably like Batman. My superpower is that I have no more superpowers than anyone else. That's my superpower, you know? And I remind myself of that to the extent that I can when I sometimes might forget that.
The humility.
But that's not to say that we all don't have, you know, extraordinary powers, but whatever mine are no more than anyone else's. Humility. I mean, yeah, I guess I try sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, or at least to stay grounded. And which is going back to why we began, you know, where we began this conversation is why I'm trying to help out the community here.
Yeah.
So, you know, through Brooklyn for Life. So, yeah. My superpower in this case is everyone around me out here.
Thanks so much to Jeff for a great interview, and thanks to you for listening. Torrey Show gives you fuel to power your dreams because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Torrey and on Instagram at Torrey Show. Torrey Show is written by me, Torrey, and produced by Jackie Garofano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhall. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back on Friday and next Wednesday with another amazing guest, because the man can't shut us down.